I've always said that what we do in the military, I don't believe is that special. Hang on. What?
Welcome to the American Grown Podcast, hosted by Austin Sullivan. The American Grown Podcast will focus on people from different walks of life and their journey to where they are now. Now, turn up your volume and settle in for a great episode.
This is the American Grown Podcast, recorded inside the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios.
Welcome back, Lou Fabrizi, to the American Grown Podcast, episode 94. For the new listeners, Lou was on the podcast back in episode 12. That was June of 2022, so it's been a little while since we connected.
Yeah.
If you haven't listened to that episode, highly recommend you go back, check it out. Lou always comes prepared. He brings some amazing bourbon. He's going to make a different take on his Centralia, which he did back in episode 12. That episode, we mainly spoke about joining the Army National Guard and becoming a Black Hawk instructor pilot. So now this episode, he's come back to talk about his deployment to the Middle East, exploring the pyramids, and also beginning transition back to civilian life.
Yeah, it's so good to be here, Austin. Thanks so much. Man, it's been, it's been like 2 years since I've been here. So
crazy.
Congratulations on all your success and getting all awesome guests. And it's super awesome to be back here. So.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome back. Yeah, let's get it started.
All right, so shall we start with a drink?
Let's do it.
All right. So the first time we did it, we did this Centralia with the hot honey at the bottom of it. So today we're actually going to do, just got back from Niagara Falls with my family. So I got some great Canadian hot syrup and we're going to do that. I'm going to go ahead and fire this up here, get some nice smoke going. Look at that.
Perfect. Look at that flame. Look at the smoke coming in.
Oh, that looks
great. Smells good too. What kind of chips did you use? Just regular?
So I'm using Pearwood.
Pearwood.
Oh, yeah, which is the same thing I used the last time.
I thought so.
And it was a lot of experimenting to find which the best wood was. And yeah, I'm pretty happy with this one there. So we're going to let that one. That's going to be yours.
Look at it wafting, the smoke just wafting out.
Look at that. That's what the ice ball does too, really nice, is it kind of keeps it in there. All right. That looks pretty good, man.
Sweet.
All right. The fire alarm's not going to go off, is it?
Oh, we'll test that out real quick.
All right, this one's yours because it's a little better.
All right.
All right, cheers, man. Good to be
cheers.
Here.
Yes, cheers. Lou, welcome back.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, it's nice, right?
Wow, that's really good.
Yeah.
I think this is a little sweeter, obviously, with that maple.
Right? Yeah, so the maple syrup is going to be a little bit sweeter than the hot honey, right?
Yeah.
But you'll see at the end, this will kind of burn at the end.
A little bit.
Which is nice, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Lou, again, thank you for being here. Thank you for your time. I'm excited to dive in and, you know, just follow up. Where are you at? Like, what have you been up to? When did you deploy? And let's just go from there.
Yeah, sure. So the last time that I was on the podcast, I was actually preparing to go on this deployment to the Middle East. And I don't think that I mentioned it because, you know, you don't want a lot of people to know. And you don't want, you know, people to know that you're leaving and you're not going to be by your house for 10 months. So anyway, I went on this deployment and, you know, nobody ever wants to leave their family, the comforts of home, all those good things that we have here. But I knew that I had to do it and it was part of my duty. And I went and it just was an unbelievable experience. I owed it to my family that if I was going to go for 10 months, that I was going to make the best out of it. And I certainly did. The people over there were awesome. The mission that we did was very different than anything I've done before. It had more of a diplomatic flair to it.
Okay.
So it was really cool to get into that type of work. So just a really awesome experience. Got to visit several different countries. Got myself immersed in the culture. And got to see how people live. And there's some things that are different and there's some things that are similar. At the end of the day, we're all kind of human beings. And that resonated with me for sure.
Yeah. When was the date? So give people a rough window. What were we looking at? How long were you over?
So, yeah, I've been back. I've actually been back almost to the day a year. So I've been home a year. So I left in, when would it have been? November of 22, right?
22, yep.
Yep.
Okay.
So I was there for 10 months and then I got home last August. So I've been home exactly.
Wow. Yeah. And just real quick, the feeling coming home.
Oh, it was unbelievable, right? Like, again, now, modern technology is nice. So I was able to video chat with my kids, my wife, my parents. You see what everyone was doing on Facebook, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was nice. But the feeling to come home is unbelievable. There's absolutely nothing like it. So, and it really makes you, again, appreciate all the nice things that we have there. And though it was an unbelievable experience to be over there, it was so good to be home. And trust me, I'm never going to go again. That was the last one.
That was the last one?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're home. And thank you and all the servicemen and women out there, because without you guys and gals, you know, we don't have the lives we have here and the freedoms we have here in America. So where were you stationed while you're over in the Middle East?
Yep. So mainly I was in Kuwait.
Okay.
Which is kind of, we've been there a long time. We've been there since the 90s. However, like I said, we had a large area to cover. So we had about 9 different countries that we concentrated while we were over there. And it was all about without going too much into it, was about building partnerships with all these different countries over there, which is, to me, is very, very fascinating to go over there and work with these people and, you know, really try to get on the same page with them. Yeah. And it's effective. It's super effective to go there and do that instead of, you know, them being your enemy. So it was really neat to do that diplomatic work.
I was just going to say more of a diplomatic mission, right?
Sure.
Than going in and eliminating a target or a threat. So while over there, what were some of the sights, some of the experiences that you had while like in Kuwait and everything?
Yeah. So what I always try to do, no matter where I go, anytime I go for military training, whether it's in the U.S. or a different country, I really try to learn the culture and get a good feeling for what's going on. Like, because you're going to learn something new with everybody. So
right.
At the time, it was very peaceful over there in that region. So we did have some freedoms to go out and, you know, visit the malls in Kuwait, have dinner in the restaurants. When you went to countries like United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Cairo, you actually got to go out and experience the culture. So it was really cool. And
so what was it like, the malls, the restaurants? Because obviously everyone's familiar here in the States, but What's it like? Because I'm sure everybody in their head has some kind of picture of what it is, but you were there firsthand.
Yeah. Okay. So most people are probably familiar with King of Prussia, pretty nice mall. Take that and multiply that by 10, and that's the malls that you have over there.
Wow.
In the Middle East, especially in Kuwait. It's very hot in Kuwait. I mean, it gets up to about 120 degrees in the summer there. I mean, it is brutally
scorching.
Hot. You know, and they're financially sound in that country, so they have these elaborate and gorgeous and super clean malls that are just, you can't believe. And I'm not sure anyone even buys anything in these malls, but they go and they walk around and they enjoy them. And
window shopping, maybe?
Yeah, and it's all, yeah, I think it's a lot of window shopping. And, you know, it's a lot of American companies. You have a lot of Italian companies, all that stuff. So any store that you would have at King of Prussia would be over there in those malls too. So it was a good way to spend a Sunday afternoon for us to go and walk around. And thank God during the time we were allowed to do that. It was nice and peaceful. And, you know,
yeah.
And I still think even in Kuwait, it's probably okay right now. But we did have that ability to go and check all those things out.
Gotcha. So these malls are top of the line, high end.
Yeah.
No expenses paid. Yeah.
Spared. Yeah.
Spared.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
And now, The restaurants and the food, the cuisine, what was some of that like?
So it's funny you ask that. You'll have every American franchise over there, right? You'll have Pizza Hut, you'll have Chick-fil-A, like Applebee's.
Really?
Yeah. So the malls were filled with those, right? And they were pretty good, pretty close. But I wasn't interested in visiting any of those type of restaurants. I ended up like going to the authentic Middle Eastern restaurants. And there was one in particular, which I believe was a Lebanese restaurant in the middle of downtown Kuwait. And one military unit keeps saying this is the place to go, and they passed that down for the last 15 years, right?
Yeah.
So one of the pictures that I sent you actually has this meat tray that they give you, and it was very reasonably priced. You know, it fed like 10 people. And unbelievable, just bursting with flavor, unbelievable. Super good quality meat there. Yeah, so it was really awesome. So about once a month, we would go to this restaurant. A little bit of a language barrier there, but not too much. We just knew what to order. We ended up we had the same waiter the whole time we were there.
Oh, that's
for
awesome.
10 months. And it was really cool. When I told him this was the last time there, he was sad. And maybe because I was a good tipper. But he was...
You guys were regulars.
Yeah, we were regulars, which was really cool to be in a different country and be a regular and get to know people. To me, that's just absolutely fascinating. What an experience.
You didn't have an interpreter or anything in your group?
Yeah. Okay. So, no. We are very lucky that the rest of the world speaks English. And they certainly speak English in those Arab and Middle Eastern countries. The reason why is because they have to bring in people from all over the world to kind of do a lot of the labor there. Kuwait's not a big country. I think that they have 5 million people. I may or may not be right on this one. About 5 million people in Kuwait, and only 2.5 million are actually Kuwaiti. So roughly 50% of people are actually Kuwaiti. So they bring in people from all over the world to do labor. And there's only one common thing that they can speak, and that's English. So whether you're talking to the Kuwaitis or the people that do all the work in the country, everybody is speaking English, and very good English. So we did not need to know any Arabic or anything like that. Every once in a while, you try to be polite and say please and thank you in Arabic. But the English. Yeah. English was over there. All the signs were in English.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because that with all the different people that live in those countries, that's the only thing common is English.
English.
Yeah, so we're very lucky. We're spoiled that we only know how to really speak one language in the United States. But the rest of the world, they can all speak English, among other things.
Multiple languages, yeah. Yeah. So in your group that you're stationed with, tell us a little bit, if you don't mind, about them. Like, is it their first deployment? Have they been there for a while? Or I'm sure you have some friends, some buddies. Anybody in that group you wanted to shout out?
Without saying any names, what I will say is that the leadership on this deployment was unbelievable. We're talking a very high tier of the military here, the two-star general tier. And those leaders that were there, they pretty much everybody that went was super experienced, right? This type of mission calls for, higher-ranking NCOs and officers and people that are experienced to do this job. So we got treated like adults. We got the freedom that we needed to get the job done. And from the top guy all the way down, it was unbelievable how well we got treated. And it just, that can make or break one of those deployments. And the fact that we had leadership that trusted us and let us do our thing just made it. It really did. And I'm very thankful for that.
Let's take a quick sip break.
Sure.
What was it like just traveling, going out?
Yeah, so it was pretty awesome. So again, we had a pretty big region that we had to cover doing these partnership exercises. So my team and I, which we basically oversaw, we weren't in charge of it, but we oversaw and coordinated a bunch of different aviation, right? Because that's my background, obviously, 25 years almost in aviation. That's what we had to do, is we had to coordinate different exercises and training opportunities, among aviation. So there were times where my deputies and I had to kind of split up and divide and conquer, right? So, I would have one of my guys over in Abu Dhabi, Dubai area, United Arab Emirates, and then I'd have to be over in Egypt, right? So the country that I took a specialty in was Egypt, which was awesome because it's not only was it fascinating work, it's a bucket list item for me to go to the pyramids.
Yeah.
And then there I found myself in downtown Cairo, which is a stone's throw away from the Giza Plateau. So that was unbelievable. And when you do these things, you have to work hard and you have to get the mission done. But we generally allow a little time for some culture, right? We call it a cultural day where you can go and visit some of these things. So part of us traveling there is we had a group that looked after us, and they would also take us down to the pyramids. So here I am now, like, dream come true. Number one bucket list item, I find myself going to the Giza Plateau, which was unbelievable. So that was after 2 weeks of hard work. Finally got that done. Now all of a sudden, I couldn't even sleep like the night before. Because it's
like a kid before Christmas.
Yeah. Like, I can't believe I'm going to the pyramids tomorrow. My number one bucket list item. Here I go.
And what is it, the pyramids for you, like when you were growing up, like what intrigues you about them?
Well, I don't know. Like, you look at the back of the dollar bill and they're there. They show up everywhere.
They do, yeah.
And it's arguably the most recognizable structure in human history. So just think about that. All the people that have lived, and these pyramids have, according to the historians, been around 4,000 years. It's the number one recognizable structure in the world. How amazing is that, right? So that's always been really cool for me to think, like, I want to go to a place that everybody on this planet knows exists.
Right.
I mean, how many things can you say that about? And then obviously the mystery behind him. No one really knows.
Right.
No one really knows what's going on.
It's the uncertainty. So that morning, I imagine you're, kid in a candy store, you're hopping out of bed. throwing both shoes on at once and going. So what is that like, you know, pulling up to the pyramids? Walk us through that experience.
Yeah. That's a great question. So what's wild about that is the pyramids just sit on the edge of Cairo, and one of the suburbs of Cairo is Giza, and it is so dense and so populated area. And the plateau sits up a few hundred feet off of the city, right? So you go from this massive urban sprawl to the pyramids in 2 minutes. Like it changes that quick. And then you go up to the pyramids, and it's just, yeah, it's a big triangle, but it just is surreal to be there and to see those things and to wonder what the heck is going on with these, you know, this gigantic stone thing that's there, it's blocking the sun. Right. Like so you're sitting there and you're looking up and it's blocking the sun. Like that's how massive.
Huge. Yeah. They're huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so there is so much about the pyramids now. I don't want to skip anything, but I know you got to go inside of it.
That's right.
Take us through that. When you get to the pyramids, is there a guide waiting for you?
Yes. Or? So okay. Yeah. Luckily, the people that we were with provided a tour. So that was nice. I actually went twice. I went, I think, once in January and once in March. So the first time that I got there in January, the tour guide recommended that we didn't go inside them. She said, there's nothing to see. You know, it's very hot. It's hard to get up. If you're claustrophobic, you're going to have a hell of a time.
Oof, yeah.
And once you get up there, there's just not much going on. So we listened to her on the first trip in January. We didn't do it. And then I kind of, and you know, it still was an amazing experience. But then when I went back in March, I'm like, you know what? I'm doing it. Like I need to go into the middle of this thing and see it. And I'm so glad that I did, because the outside of the pyramid is made with limestone blocks, right? But the whole inside, the grand gallery going up into the king's chamber, is all granite. So we know that the limestone rocks came from a quarry on the other side of the Nile River, mm-hmm. right? You can actually still see it carved out, which is wild, right?
It's wild, yeah. Holy cow. Thousands and thousands of years ago,
But the granite, we're pretty sure it comes from very far away. In Upper Egypt, which is actually south. They call it Upper Egypt because the elevation's higher.
Okay.
Right. And that's up in the Valley of the Kings and the Aswan Dam and all that stuff like that. So they had to get these granite blocks, which weigh a lot more than limestone, and they built the interior of the pyramid out of granite. And one thing that we were talking about, you know, before this all started was the joints on these granite blocks are unbelievable. Like, they are perfect. They are square, and, you know, what they're saying is they cut those with bronze tools.
Yeah.
Maybe the limestone, but the granite? And I couldn't believe it. I remember, you know, the biggest takeaway for me is I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I'm looking at, and you can post some of these pictures with the blocks in the background, how perfect they are, and it feels like they were done yesterday, and they weren't. They were done 4,000 years ago or whatever. Hopefully someday we'll actually figure out what happened, you know, when they actually did. There's not a whole lot of record on those pyramids, especially the Great Pyramid of Giza. The historians say that it was the tomb of Khufu, and it was built a little over 4,000 years ago, but there's nothing that says that. There's no hieroglyphics. There's no good history. And, you know, you and I were talking earlier, I think it would be naive of us to think that we have that completely figured out.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably find out some stuff over time as technology gets better. They're doing all kind of like LIDAR into there, and they're finding new chambers and all kind of stuff. I don't think we have that 100% figured out. You know, I'm not going to get into any like weird conspiracies about aliens.
Right.
I don't necessarily believe that. But what I do believe is I don't think we have that 100% figured out.
Yeah.
It would be naive of us to think that we know exactly why they were built, what their purpose was, and who did it. And maybe the timing might be off too.
That could be. It's just so interesting because we don't know so much about them. And, you know, you watch different like History Channel, Discovery Channel, and it's like, oh, the pyramids were, like you said, the different chambers were tombs for the kings.
Right.
Or no, it could have been like for electric currents. I've heard that there was a way to get electric currents. And then I believe those, because it's three pyramids, correct?
Well, there's three.
Or am I off? Where?
No, there's three large ones.
Two large ones.
Yep. And then there's several other ones. I think that there's eight total. Yeah. And there's smaller ones that were the queen's chambers.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I believe from either History or Discovery Channel, you know, because I don't really know, but those three coalesced with like the stars, I think, maybe on Orion's belt.
That's correct.
And again, okay, so I do know a little bit of craziness.
You do. So that reminds me, right? So we talk about the Great Pyramid of Giza. Okay, so here's some things. I was talking to you earlier about the 52-degree slope, right? And I said a few minutes ago that it blocks out the sun. When you sit at the base of the Great Pyramid of Giza and you look up 52 degrees, you can't see the top of it, right? 2.3 million limestone blocks to construct that, okay? Wow. 52 degrees straight up, perfect triangle, right? Actually, it's 51 and 52. The pyramid is actually, they found out recently, eight-sided.
Eight-sided?
Eight-sided, right? So it kind of comes to, on the four sides of it, those sides are broken in half and they come to like a little bit of a point. They are aligned perfectly to the cardinal directions. And there's theories about the other two pyramids. They're also aligned and they line up with Orion's belt. Crazy stuff.
That is crazy.
So they obviously knew a lot about astronomy, right?
Yes.
They understood the winter, the summer solstice, all those different things. And they understood the stars, you know, and they lined these up for a certain reason, which we would be completely naive to think we know what that reason is.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we just think of it as like, oh, you know, some of the conspiracy theorists, and I'll just throw this out there, but, you know, aliens might have built it. But yet, think about it. Back then, there were no smartphones. There were no cars. So what did they do? They studied the stars. They invested in history and learning, you know, everything and anything. So even though it was with bronze tools, maybe, you know, maybe they could pull it off. You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
But yet, we're just so, I mean, you sit on a smartphone or on your computer for hours working and things like that, but yet what'd they have back then? They didn't have that.
They were certainly a busy civilization, but they had time at night to look up at the stars with no light pollution, right? So they spent a lot of time looking up at the stars and wondering what the heck's going on. So unbelievably fascinating. And like I said, to be there and to be inside the king's chamber in the middle of that thing, in the middle of that pyramid, those 2.3 million blocks, which is just unbelievable. What an experience. And I tried to sit there and take it in as much as I can.
I say, what did it feel like? Like your emotions, what were you feeling being in there?
Yeah, I don't even know. I don't even know because you fight with yourself. You're like, take it all in, take a bunch of pictures, you know, like you have to find a balance of experiencing it, but also documenting it too. And I'm glad. And I thought I don't even know what I was thinking when I look back on it now. I'm just glad that I did it. I'm glad on the second trip I went up and went into the king's chambers and went into the middle of it. They actually let you lay in. There's a block in the middle of it, and that's supposed to be where Khufu was buried. Now, they have never found a mummy in there.
They have never found anything
in there. So, again, I just think we need to keep studying it and not accept it completely what, you know, Egyptologists are telling us, because I think there's more to learn. Go ahead.
I was going to say, but you laid where they're saying the casket was? You got to like lay in there.
I found out later that you're actually allowed to go in it and lay down in it.
Yeah.
The picture that I have is actually me kind of putting my arms on top of it.
Yeah, leaning against it. Wow.
Yeah, and some people say that if you go in there and lay, you can almost have like a kind of like an
out of body experience or something.
Exactly. I didn't get to do that. Now, if I ever go back again, I would do it. And I should say that I'm not encouraging everybody to go to Cairo because I know a lot of people want to do it, but it is safe. It is safe. That economy really relies on tourism, right? So if you're ever thinking about doing a river cruise or anything there, I think you should explore the idea of doing it. And it is fairly safe. Obviously, that's going to depend on what's going on in the world, but they really have to take care to make sure people are going to continue to come there, right? So there's a lot of security. It's pretty safe.
Well, that's good to know because I've seen videos on social media about the pyramids and like people going up to them, taking pictures and things. But then it seems like a lot of locals that are selling or trying to get you to come this way. I'll give you a tour to, you know, secret tour or something like that.
Yeah.
Is that a true thing? Real?
They've gotten rid of a lot of it. There's still a little bit of it that's left, but you just say no and walk away. And they leave you alone.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So also on the Giza Plateau is the Sphinx, right? That's another mysterious thing there. I mean, to me, that's actually probably a bigger mystery, right? There's been a lot of work done about the possible water erosion at the bottom of it. Again, we just need to be open to more people studying that structure. Because there's a theory.
Okay, hit me.
That the base of that was actually built prior to the Ice Age, right? What? Because what? That's the last time that region would have had water in it, right? I'm not saying I believe in it or not. I just think we should continue studying these and not accept all the different things that are out there. We learn new stuff about the humans every single day.
Yeah.
We keep finding new things that say humans are older than we think they are. Again, new information will bring in different studies, right? So, I mean, that structure is bizarre. The head does not fit.
I was going to say the head's been manipulated or updated over time.
Yeah. And, it should be way bigger. So obviously the body is a lion and then the top is one of the pharaohs. So, that thing's probably been rebuilt over top of it. And again, we just need to be open to continuing to study that structure.
And I believe there's a lot of underground tunnels and chambers under the Sphinx that haven't even been explored. I forget where I heard that, if it was on social media. And again, you can't believe everything you hear on social media, but that's the kind of take that I've heard. But yet people aren't going down or aren't allowed. The Egyptian government maybe is not letting them. I don't know. But like you said, it'd be so just be open and explore, because it is human history, right? It's not just Egyptian history. It's history of the world. And everybody's curious about what is it? What took place there?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's, again, the mystery behind it is unbelievable. One of the other things I did right after I visited the Giza Plateau is I went to the Mummy Museum.
Okay.
And you're not allowed to take any pictures. You have to walk down there and be in complete silence. And you walk down in there and they have all the mummies consolidated in one museum. So you're looking at the actual bodies of human beings that are anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 years old. And you're looking at them. You can still see they have fingernails and toenails. It's wild, man.
It's wild.
It is so wild to see that. They have a bunch of artifacts too in that museum too. So it was wild to see everything that they did.
Wow.
I was so grateful that I got the opportunity. Yeah. So that was 2 days of my life, the one time in January and the one time in March. Those were 2 days that I maximized as much as I possibly could.
Oh, I believe
it. And I'd like to go back as a tourist and visit Upper Egypt, which is the Valley of the Kings. That's where you start seeing the hieroglyphics and all the different things there. Really where ancient Egypt gets documented very well. They were very good record keepers. The pyramids, the Sphinx, not so much. We don't really have anything written on them. Nothing. So it's wild.
And we're talking off air about the Rosetta Stone you'd mentioned, because you're talking about the hieroglyphics and everything. Now, did you get to see that or tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I don't know a whole lot about the Rosetta Stone. What I do know is they found a tablet, I believe, in Alexandria. Don't quote me on that, but they found the stone. And it had certain documents that were written in hieroglyphics and Greek, and I think another language, maybe Persian again. I don't know at all, but they were able to verify through that one piece of stone what they thought about hieroglyphics. So they were able to see something written in Greek. They know the exact same thing was written in hieroglyphics. And then from there, they were like, yep, we can now read.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's like a key to that language.
That was a key. I believe it's considered one of the greatest historical discoveries of all time, because now you can verify what the hieroglyphics actually meant. And then we were able to, when we did see hieroglyphics, we were able to find out that the Egyptians did document everything pretty good. That stuff is probably not up for debate. The stuff that didn't have the hieroglyphics, like the whole Giza Plateau, maybe we should look into it a little more.
Definitely.
And this LIDAR technology and stuff they have where they just found a new chamber within the last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's apparently the same size as the Grand Gallery. There's a lot of stuff online about that. So we're far from understanding what that was for. Yep.
Wow. It's amazing. It sounds like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And the fact that you have a love for and a passion and getting to be there and go inside of it. Were you claustrophobic at all?
No, not at all.
No? Okay.
Now, the climb is tough. From the Grand Gallery into the King's Chamber, it's very steep. And you have to kind of hold on to a rope and pull yourself up. There were some people that were struggling with it, and it was hot. I mean, probably 140 degrees, 120, 140 degrees inside that thing.
Wow.
So you're sweating pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why you lost all that weight.
Yeah.
I just say, holy cow, you showed me a picture. I was like, skin and bone. I mean, obviously not, but.
Yeah, it was nice too, because we were eating pretty healthy. Obviously weren't drinking any alcohol. So that helps a lot. Like we're drinking, on a Sunday here. Right. So this is how the weight gets back on.
Yeah. Welcome back home. Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
And then one other thing I got to do was we went into the tent makers market, which is this, thousand-year-old market in downtown Cairo. They've been trading goods in there throughout all human history. and a bunch of it still looks the same. And what was really neat about going into that market was some things actually don't change over a long period of time. So it was really neat to kind of see everyone with all handmade goods, that type of thing. And there's kind of the touristy area of the market, but we kind of went deeper into the, this is where everyone shops. So I got some really cool artifacts from there, souvenirs, that type of thing. But just seeing how the people lived was crazy. So nice people, very, very nice people. They just all want to mind their own business and get on with their life, just like everybody else.
So in the market, like I picture our market here in Lebanon, or just here in general, you know, it's got like the pretzel stand, you got the veggies, you got the candies, the chickens over here, that sort of thing, the baked goods. What is their market laid out as? I mean, is there food, or is it all kind of like antiques and things like that? What's going on?
Yeah, so it's all that, right? So it's everyday goods, it's food. The chickens are still alive when you walk past them.
Okay.
Right? And then you see the chickens in the window right next to them that are cut up and butchered, right? So it's wild to see. It's probably not as sanitary as you'd like it to be, but this is how these people have been living a long time. I'll show you some other pictures after this of just the stuff that went on in that market. But it's everything. Yeah, it's artifacts, everyday good, it's souvenirs. You know, they have everything there. And a lot of food. This is where people go shopping. Cairo has 22 million people in it, right? So this includes downtown Cairo and the suburbs that surround it. Fifth largest city in the world, right? Which I never realized. And just a massive amount of people going in a different direction in different vehicles. I showed you that video before this.
Yeah.
And between the motorcycles, the bicycles, and the tuk-tuks, right? Which is the three-wheeled little things that you see. And everybody is going in a different direction at the same time. And it's utter chaos, but somehow it works. Yeah. 22 million people all going somewhere.
22 million people, fifth largest city in the world. Never knew that. And yet the video you showed was, it was like controlled chaos, right? It was like they're moving around and in ways that, like here in the States, I'm like, oh no, I'd never, you know, we don't cross the lines here. You know, there's lines in the road, yellow line, dotted line. These guys, they're everywhere.
You know, and it's, to us, it looks like an absolute safety disaster. People are standing on top of trucks and they're sitting in trunks and like
donkeys are pulling, you know,
it is utter chaos, but somehow there's not a lot of problems. There's not a lot of wrecks. There's none of that stuff. Like it's unbelievable. People are running across the street and it is crazy. They figured out a way to make it work. Put 22 million people there. It works.
Yeah.
It was something else. You know, listeners probably have seen like traffic cameras in India and stuff, like these high dense areas. That's what it was like in Cairo.
At what point, like, so where are we at, like, in the journey of, you know, eventually you're going to be coming home.
Sure.
So is there any other things we need to cover? I'm just trying to think.
Well, yeah. So,
please.
I wasn't always traveling. That was a very small portion. The most of the time I was in Kuwait doing the coordination with the aviation stuff, which is really cool. Life on the base in Kuwait was really neat. There was a lot to do. We actually put together a softball team. It was hot. I mean, we're talking about 120 degree weather, but put a softball team together and they had a nice little softball field. They made out of AstroTurf. So it was pretty nice. There was a lot to do. You know, the camaraderie was amazing. And what was neat about our softball team is we were certainly older, right? We were probably in our late 30s, 40s, that age, and we did really good.
Yeah.
So we ended up playing in the championship, and we took the bronze medal, which is cool.
Oh, sweet.
So for a bunch of old dudes, we'll take it for sure.
So who are you playing? Is it local teams? Is it other service members?
Yeah, so I think the base that I was on had about 4,000 people. So there was enough to...
Wow.
Yeah, there was enough. And again, I don't know if that's right. I think it's probably pretty close. There was enough to put, you know, 10, 15 teams together.
So, all right, so let's talk about these bases a little bit, because when obviously we see in the movies, right, it's maybe a small force of 200-300 or something like that, which I don't think is small, but this is 4,000, roughly 4,000 people. It's a military base.
Yeah.
On base, then, I mean, you have your own, obviously, bed, showers, weight room kind of thing. Like,
sure.
What is that like? What's the atmosphere like?
The atmosphere is pretty cool. It's as best as it could be, right? So, again, we've been there a long time. So we have these bases that are way out in the desert. They're kind of away from Kuwait City, and they're well done. They have USOs in them. They have small movie theater. The gyms are all really big tents, like circus tents, air conditioning, great equipment. You can work out as much as you want there. There was a swimming pool. which was really nice.
Yeah. Very nice. With that kind of temperature. Wow.
The environment was austere, but the actual base was pretty well hooked up. And it had like an unofficial nightlife to it. And I don't mean that it was partying because we weren't allowed to drink alcohol, but there was just people hanging out at the PX and, you know, there was a lot of different groups. There was, you know, again, the softball, these different things. There was a basketball. So there was enough to do to keep you busy. Because one thing, if I, you know, I've been in the military 25 years. You don't want a bunch of people having idle time. So yeah. If you can keep them busy, they're going to stay out of trouble. So it was really cool to see that life. My particular living area was like a small trailer. And it was very comfortable. It was air conditioning. I had a small little bed. But it was my own room, which was very nice. And then I, you know, walked to a shower and a shower and a bathroom. So it wasn't too bad. It was very comfortable.
Yeah.
We'll get used to anything. You spend enough time in a certain area. But also, living in tight quarters like that is also what makes the camaraderie come alive. You know what I mean? You learn to live with people. Yeah, people annoy each other, but that's what builds that brotherhood, right? And it's pretty awesome.
And these are people from all over, right? Not just the states, but I mean, of course, like Ohio, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, probably New York, New Jersey, wherever.
Everywhere.
But then also throughout the world, right?
Yes.
4,000 some people.
Yeah, and our base was an international base. So I hung out with some really cool guys from Italy and Spain and England.
Yeah.
It just was out in France. So it was fascinating. We were all there doing the same thing. So again, like, all these experiences are super cool when you meet these people. And at the end of the day, people are humans.
Yeah.
And most people, in my experience, are nice. They're friends. So it was really cool to on this level of work, to meet with all these people in different countries. It was really cool. I did get to play a lot of guitar at night. The guitar that I had on the last time that I took from Wilbur Wolf's farm.
Yes.
You had him on as a guest, right?
Wilbur, phenomenal.
Yeah, isn't he awesome?
Shout out to Wilbur, yes.
So I took that guitar overseas and I played it every single day at night. And I also got a little jam session going in one of the chapels. So the chapel kind of had like a little stage on it. And I just reserved it every Thursday night. The first few weeks, one or two people would show up. By the time we left, 20 people would show up. And wow. it would just be these free-for-all jams. And it taught me a whole bunch of new music that I wasn't, you know, privy to. And I learned a whole bunch of different things. And I've made lifelong friends just from those jam nights. And I actually have met up with a bunch of them since I've been home.
Really?
And I'm actually putting together a little reunion in October. And we're all going to get together and jam again.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, so we got a few people coming from Philadelphia, from New York City. And it's really cool. It was just so awesome to jam with people. And when you show up for these jam sessions, you're in civilian clothes, right? You know, just t-shirt and shorts or whatever. No one knows your rank. No one knows where you're from. You just get in jam. And that people are very comfortable in that situation, which is neat. So
that is neat because I imagine, you know, it can be stressful at times. And to have like an outlet like that where everyone can get together and it doesn't matter if you're a higher up ranking, you know, military or not, you know, you're just together as human beings jamming out. You know, having a good time.
Yeah.
So some of the music, like you said, you learned some different techniques, maybe, or ways of playing or just
sure.
songs.
Yeah. So the one that sticks out to me the most was I had my little jam sessions after gospel practice. Right. So a lot of those same people would stay afterwards and they would, if you grow up in the church, you learn how to play every instrument. So you play piano, drums, guitar, bass, like, you know how to do it all. So there was a lot of chord structure. That music is very complicated, right? So there's a few different progressions that I took from it. And I'd be like, what's that chord you're playing, dude? And he'd be like, it's an E, you know, an E major seventh. And I'm like, whoa, that's crazy, right? So he'd show me how to do it. And at first my fingers were all kind of stiff and fumbly. And then I figured out how to play the chord. And then I would incorporate it into my playing a little bit, which is really cool. And I still keep in touch with that dude that's taught me all these new chord structures. And I'm not a great player, but it certainly expanded what I was doing. That's what keeps you going as a musician. When you learn something new, it's like you're starting all over again, and it keeps it just super fresh and interesting. So I love those dudes, those guys and those girls. They were great. And I look forward to keeping in touch with them.
Lou, I'll tell you, it's amazing because, you know, I guess from the movies and books and things, you feel like sometimes our servicemen and women, it's just you're on your mission. And that's it. And, you know, but you're really learning culture too. And you're out there representing America, but yet you're learning so much and becoming one with, like, you know, the cultures of the world. It's really
so eye-opening. One thing that it took me about 25 years to realize, I've always said that what we do in the military, I don't believe is that special. Hang on.
I was like, wait, what?
Hang on. Okay. I'm gonna get to my point, right? So there are plenty of hard jobs in this world. You know, if you're a nurse or a doctor or an EMT, these are all very difficult jobs. There's so many difficult jobs out there. I could think of 20 jobs off the top of my head I would never want to do. Okay. So my point there is, I think the actual work that we do is not overly difficult, right? But it is different. Okay. And then when you go away and you go to a different country, or you spend 10 months living in close quarters, that creates an experience like no other. So the whole, when someone says thank you for your service and stuff, that I really appreciate that. But I also want to say that there's a lot of other hard stuff out there. I mean, being a police officer is tough.
Yeah.
All these things are tough. But because our scenario puts us in different places and, you know, different environments, that creates a camaraderie that I think is pretty special. So I think there's something very special about being a post 9/11 veteran, right? And what's crazy is we're on two full generations now of post 9/11 veterans, right? So there's someone like me that's been in for 25 years. And then one of the guys I had working for me was born after I enlisted.
Wow.
Yeah. So like we have two generations of post 9/11 veterans right now, you know, and again, we are a special group of people with a special sense of humor that we've went through some stuff that wasn't any harder, but different. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's kind of the point I want to get across there, that I don't think it's any more difficult than other hard jobs, but it just puts us that we only get each other. You know what I mean? And it's pretty cool. And that's a hard thing to try to explain in words. It's just a thing. You know what I mean?
It was this brotherhood, right? And the only thing I can compare it to is like when I played football in high school, it was a brother, but it's probably not even, there's nothing to compare it to, you know,
that,
really.
That would certainly be the best parallel there is sports. Going through that type of stuff, doing it together, failing or succeeding together, that is a great parallel. And I would say that's probably pretty close.
Wow. So now I want to talk about too, you're going to transition here. What did you say, September 2025? So
that's
literally
correct,
about this time next year.
That's correct. And then what's crazy about it is by the time I am, you know, I take leave and everything, I'm well under a year at this point. So I had decided after this deployment that it was such an amazing experience. I've accomplished everything that I wanted to in the military and my career. And at age 43, it was a time for me to make my transition, right? I could try to stick around and make the next rank, but I think I want to make this, I want to do it now. Mm-hmm. And I'm ready to go out there and take the things that I've learned and the experiences I've had and apply them to the civilian world. What I am learning already is that it's going to be a difficult transition. It may be the hardest thing I've done in my entire life. You're so used to operating in an environment where, you know, you're going after a similar thing. And then when you go out in the civilian world, it's different. It's not any worse or better, but it is different. And I have to take my 25-year military brain and start, you know, maybe figuring where I fit. You know what I mean? And it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be tough. I'm already seeing now as I talk to people when I prepare for my next career and my next jobs, that it's going to be tough. You know what I mean? So I'm as tough as it is, I'm that much excited about it because it is a brand new experience that I can't wait to go through.
It's a new chapter, right?
Yeah.
And with that will come failures and success and, you know, learning. You're always learning.
Yeah.
So now what do you think will be one of the hardest hurdles to overcome again, in the transition to civilian life?
So you develop a certain personality in the military, right? And you develop your leadership style, especially as you come up in rank, right? You want to define your leadership style and you want to continue refining it, making adjustments and all that stuff. And then finally you get there. And then will that then translate out there into the civilian world? I don't know that answer. So I think that that's going to be the toughest thing. Do I be me? Do I not be me? Like, I don't know. This is brand new. Again, at 43 years old, this is a brand new thing that I will have to try to figure out. Yeah. Am I coming on too strong? Am I not coming on strong enough? In the military, we use this thing called bluff, right? Bottom line up front. So I want to get to the bottom line up front with people, but okay, that might be too aggressive. You know what I mean? I just don't know. These are things that I have to try to learn over the next few years. And I think it's going to be interesting. like I said, I'm nervous, but I'm also super excited at the same time because I want to learn how to do this.
What's nice is you have skills and knowledge of many things,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you can take to the workforce or to this next chapter. What are your plans? Like, okay, so to see, how does it work? Like, does the military help you place you in a job, or are they kind of like, hey, here's last paycheck kind of thing. You're on your own. Like, how does it work? I really don't know.
They are surprisingly supportive. We have to go through this program called TAP, Transition Assistance Program. And you can go to it as many times you want. It's these week-long seminars where they talk about, you know, anything from how to develop your LinkedIn page, to job boards, yeah. to, you know, VA disability benefits, all that type of stuff. And it is super, super, there's a lot of knowledge to be learned there, and they try to place you for jobs. They even allow you to do an internship if you apply for it, where you're still in the military, but you work for a corporation out there. You show up in civilian clothes, you can have a beard, you know, that type of thing. It's really cool. So I will say they do a great job with the transition. They want to try as best as they can to set you up for success,
which I
appreciate. It is really, really impressive.
Yeah. So you grow a goatee or a mustache? Or
I'm going full beard.
Are you going full beard?
Yeah. I don't know how good it's going to grow in because, again, when I came home from the deployment, I had 2 months off. So I had a 2-month beard and I really liked it. I cannot wait not to shave. Like that's one of my biggest things. Like,
is it okay?
Yeah. If I get a job, the first question would be like, I don't have to shave, right? Like, cause I've been shaving for 25 right. years. I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then we'll have to do a part 3 with your full beard and everything.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
I can't wait to do that.
Sweet. So what are you looking at? What are you looking at for, like, do you have any ideas career wise?
Thinking? So there's a few things I have going. They're all very exciting. I don't know if any of them are going to pan out or not, but, what I would really like to do is nonprofit work in veterans affairs, right? So there's a bunch of really good charities out there. There's some that are not so good, but, you know, being an executive director or something for a veterans nonprofit would be absolute ideal for me. I think, you know, I still need to be around veterans. I think that's important for me as I go forward. So if I can do something where I could be around veterans and also help veterans, that's ideal for me. Who knows? I may go to corporate America. You know, I don't know, but I'd really like to stay in the nonprofit sector. I've done a lot of volunteering over the years for veterans organization. If I can find a way to get an executive director job, I'd be really open to that.
I think it'd be a perfect fit.
I would love doing that. Yeah. So that's ideal, but I just don't know. And again, that's part of the, like the pyramids, it's part of the mystery, but yeah. It's exciting to me and also nerve-wracking at the same time.
The item you brought with you today,
sure.
Other than Buffalo Trace in that, which sure. is phenomenal. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, what do you have there? It's a framed something.
Yeah. So what's really cool about this piece is part of the tour that I took on the Giza Plateau, they take you to, you don't want to go to Egypt and buy something that was made in China, right? You want to go to Egypt and buy something that was made in Egypt. So the tour guide took us to government insured authentic Egyptian artifact stores.
Legit.
So one of the stores they always take you to is the papyrus store, right? And it's just this unbelievable art gallery. Everything is painted on papyrus, right? So there's a few places in what pretty much anywhere you go in Egypt, you can find papyrus paintings. The problem is most of them are made on banana leaves.
What?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. So you think you may be buying something on papyrus, but it's actually banana leaves, right? So this one has a government-insured papyrus. The government actually controls the growing of papyrus. It's obviously it's a water plant that grows on the shores of the Nile in a very specific part of Cairo, and the government owns it all. They oversee all that. They have that on lockdown, right? So this was one of the government-insured places. They make the papyrus right in front of you. They've been doing it the same way for 4,000 years. Essentially,
wow.
You interweave, you dry these plants out, you interweave them, you wet them, and then you push them down on a press. Back in the day, they took two rocks and squashed it down. Papyrus lasts forever. It never deteriorates like paper or cardboard will, and it is waterproof. So it can get wet. It can be anywhere you want. This is why so many documents in you know, the New Kingdom of ancient Egypt have survived, because papyrus holds up. Nothing will ever come close to it. So what I got here, I bought several of these. I went crazy. I spent a ton of money on it, right? This is one of the ones that I got framed. And essentially what this is music in the New Kingdom of Egypt. All the musicians in the New Kingdom of Egypt were female initially.
Really?
Yeah. And what's really cool about this is they use music very similar how we use it in modern day. They would use it for funerals. They would use it for parties, promotion ceremonies, coronation of the new pharaoh, whatever it may be. There is music everywhere, just like we have today. And what's really cool is one of the ladies there is playing a lute. Okay, so the one, there's two of them actually there, but the far left and the far right, they're playing the lute. So the lute ends up kind of traveling all over Europe, all into England and Spain, and eventually it becomes the guitar. Right.
What?
So the lute goes into, you know, Italy and France, that becomes a mandolin. And then other parts of the Middle East develop the oud, which is a very similar instrument.
Okay.
And now all of a sudden this thing's getting passed. And when the Roman Empire kind of gets bigger, they're taking these lutes everywhere with them and every place it goes. So it goes into England. Right. And then it ends up becoming, especially in medieval times, the lute comes back. Then it gets down to Spain and it becomes a Spanish guitar, so on and so forth, right? So you can trace what she's playing there to modern day guitar.
Wow.
So I had to buy this.
You had to get it.
I had.
It's meant to be.
I had to get this. So this is a hand-painted piece by a local artist in Cairo. And then it actually, down in hieroglyphics, has my name down at the bottom.
Oh, really?
So you buy the piece.
Yeah.
And then they'll say, what do you want to put on it, right? So I have this awesome one at home where it's... you have the pharaoh, the queen, and two children, which represents my family, right? And then it has everybody's name in my family written in hieroglyphics. This one just kind of, I think it says Lou Fabrizi right on it.
But, yeah, yeah.
So this hangs in my studio, in my base, my music studio in my basement. And the way that I translate it is this is the first ever rock band, right?
I love it, yeah.
Is a bunch of women playing these instruments
yeah.
at a party in Egypt. So it's pretty, it's
pretty awesome.
Pretty yeah, awesome piece. Pretty awesome. And I got this framed at, in Carlisle, and you want to expose the papyrus, right? So the papyrus actually sits on top of the framing, right? Which is really cool. And that's UV protected glass and everything like that. But a beautiful piece and really, really interesting stuff. And it is 100% legit papyrus.
Wow. Yeah. It's the real deal.
It's the real deal. Same way they've been doing it for 4,000 years.
That's wild. And we can take a picture of that for social media so everybody can see. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Man. Lou, that's awesome.
Yeah.
We're getting to the end. I mean.
Yeah?
Yeah. All right. So let's real quick. Social media, right? Now that you're getting back to civilian life, if people want to connect with you, want to learn more about you, maybe hire you. You never know. Job offerings. What's the best way to reach you? Social media and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So in that case, I would just say my LinkedIn for sure, right? And if you search up Lou Fabrizi and you see my smiling face there, that'll be me. So if someone does want to get a hold of me and talk about some different things or follow up with some things, I think LinkedIn's the best way to go. I keep my my Facebook kind of personal, that type of thing. But yeah, absolutely hit me up on LinkedIn. I want to be able to, as I transition to this new career, I want to have a bunch of different options and pick the right fit. One thing that's fascinating, though, is career military and veterans will – on average, go 2 to 3 different jobs post their military career before they find the right one. And I think that's because that transition's so hard and, you know, you have to find the right fit. Or maybe you kind of start easing up as you get into different jobs and it takes a little while. Like I said, it's going to be a heck of a transition. I'm looking forward to it, but nervous as hell, for real.
Oh, you'll be great. You'll be fine. You'll do great. Now, are you going to still continue into... music, still going to pursue that and everything?
Yeah. I am. So just when I think I want to take a break for a while, new opportunities present, jamming with some new guys here, doing some things. And I also do my stuff on the side. So I do have a music video out that I did.
I thought I saw something about that.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
That turned out pretty good. It was a song that I wrote when I was overseas. And then I went and I recorded it with my friends when I got back. And I thought it was... an unbelievable song. It turns out that it's good, but it's not great, right? It's a good song. But here's what I'll say about it. I'm very proud of it. It was about my time over there and how I miss my family and stuff like that. So it is unbelievably genuine song. Musically, it's okay. It's not great. But it is something from the heart. So when I look back at how the song turned out, the musicians that I got that I played with, and then the music video that we did, I'm very, very proud of it. I don't care if a million people watch it or 2 people watch it. very proud of it.
What's the song?
It's called This Light.
This Light?
This
okay.
Light.
Is it on YouTube? Where can people watch it?
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Spotify?
It is on Spotify, yes.
Oh, snap.
Yep.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you just type in This Light.
Lou Fabrizi,
you'll see it.
Awesome.
And I forget what it's called, but like the picture of the song is that picture of me hugging my family when I came.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, it's a great picture. Oh, yeah. Sweet.
And the music video came out pretty good. And like I said, it's a good song. I'm very proud of it. And one thing I learned with music is, you know, you just got to be happy with what you're doing. Mm. You know what I mean? Hardly anyone ever makes it anymore. You know, my kids watch like YouTube shorts and there's a bazillion views of a guy doing absolutely nothing, right?
Yeah.
So it's not about views. It's not about likes. It's not about any of that. Are you proud of the music and the art that you made? And I certainly am. So I'll leave it at that.
I like that a lot. I mean, that's like with a podcast. It's not about the views. It's about the people, the connections, the relationships, you know, the authenticity, like you're saying. I mean, if it's from the heart, you never know. I mean, the possibilities are endless. But if you don't do it, like I've said on previous episodes here on the podcast, you know, if you don't take that step or that leap of faith and put yourself out there on a video, on a podcast, on a song, you'll never know. And you can't let other people, what they think about you, keep you from doing that, keep you from chasing your dream or putting stuff out there, because you never know, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's what impresses me about your podcast so much is you keep doing it, you keep getting interesting people, you know what I mean? And that's awesome because it's so easy to quit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the easiest thing to do, right? But go after it, man. Follow what you want to do. And if at the end of the night you're happy with your product, you're happy with your podcast, your song, your painting, your poem, whatever it may be, that's all you need.
Yeah.
It's all you need. All you need with art.
I appreciate that, Lou. Yeah, I appreciate hearing that because it is. It's a lot of behind the scenes and a lot of sometimes you doubt yourself. Oh, why do I keep doing this? And it's like I said, it's the relationship. It's the people.
Sure.
I mean, you and I have known each other since, gosh, before COVID. And to get to talk to you and learn more about you, that's what it's all about. It's sharing stories, sharing, you know, that's what you're doing in song. It's sharing stories.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we're doing an event together here in October, right?
Yes, we are. Yeah. I'm excited for that. That'll be great.
It's going to be good. At the Englewood, that place is rocking.
Yeah. You know, I looked into it. I have not ever been there. So I'm really excited. Get to break out the camera and do my thing there. For the listeners that don't know, I'm a sports photographer. I do portraits and all that. And that's a part of, you know, Blue Cardinal Photography here at Color Tech. It all kind of meshes. And
yeah, and that's how we met, was you were doing some formal pictures for a military formal.
Yeah.
And I was like, I like this guy.
Yeah, we did kind of.
He actually got me to smile and not look ridiculous. So that's
pretty
cool.
Did I do? Yeah, I did a good job. Yeah. Did a good job.
You made me laugh for sure.
Nice. Okay, sweet, Lou. Great. Awesome. Yeah. You know, it's been a lot of fun. Before we close out, anything else you want to share with the listeners? Any last bit of information?
My family's going to listen to this, and I really appreciate what they did while I was gone. You know, that it was way harder on them than it was on me. And I certainly acknowledge that and appreciate it. And I'm just thankful for the family that I have. And it's been great. And I promise I'm not going anywhere again. So obviously the military retirement will take care of that. But that was a one and done. I had a great experience. I got the best I could out of it. But I'm so grateful for them supporting me through that. And it's finally over. So
perfect.
Yeah.
Lou Fabrizi on the American Grown Podcast and the Color Tech Creative Solutions Studios. Thank you for joining me.
Cheers, my man.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. To see photos of today's guests and more content, just search American Grown Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to be a featured guest on the podcast, please direct message or email Austin at AmericanGrownPod@gmail.com.
This episode was brought to you by these sponsors.
Cleona Coffee Roasters is a small batch coffee roastery and coffee shop, veteran and first responder owned, community oriented, and roasted fresh to order. Now open inside 911 Rapid Response, Anvil, PA. Go to CleonaCoffeeRoasters.com to order online, see updated hours, and find where you can buy it close to you.
Triggered 22 LLC, a veteran owned apparel company. By purchasing a t-shirt, hat, or hoodie from Triggered 22, you're not only supporting a small business, but you're bringing awareness to veteran PTSD and suicide. Please help save the lives of those who fought for our freedoms. Visit triggered22.com now and place your order. Let's help those suffering from invisible wounds.